This hour's top stories: a UN-backed international treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons shunned by nuclear-armed states enters into force. Local Syrian officials say four civilians have been killed and several more injured in the latest Israeli missile attack near the western city of Hama. And Japan says it is determined to hold the Tokyo Olympics this year, denying reports of the cancellation of the games due to the coronavirus pandemic. Welcome to the program. The International Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons has taken effect, but without the signatures of the world's major nuclear powers. The treaty, among other things, seeks to prohibit the use, development, and production of nuclear weapons. It was originally adopted by 122 countries in the UN General Assembly in 2017. The treaty was due to take effect 90 days after the 50th signature. Nuclear powers, including the U.S., the UK, France, Russia, and Israel have not signed it, yet the fact that it took effect was praised by the UN. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said the treaty is an important step towards the goal of a world free of nuclear weapons. Let's discuss this a little bit further with the help of Mr. Joseph Dube. I believe he is an arms control activist and campaigner who joins us via Skype out of the city of Johannesburg in South Africa. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Your reaction to this, does this make you happy that the treaty has actually taken effect? Or is there still room for concern, you know, with these five countries still not signing it?
Good day, sir. I think the community and the world at large celebrates that the nuclear weapons are now illegal, and all along it has been morally wrong to have nuclear weapons in any state. And I think whether we do or we don't have those five states, I think generally, if you look at the history of disarmament, most of these particular states have always been reluctant to join these treaties. And the good part is that whether they are in or not, other disarmament treaties have shown the compliance, even those countries that refuse to sign or ratify. They will be forced by the environment, by the globe, to say you need to be part of the solution to address what happened 75 years ago in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki.
When you have a state like Israel that hasn't actually signed this treaty, you know, it's among those countries and is holding one of the largest nuclear stockpiles, and not having signed anything regarding that, you know, and not actually letting any controlled bodies to come in and inspect. How hopeful are you that this, perhaps, because you said they will be pushed, and you know, I was dubious about this. Could you just explain this a little bit further? How can that be?
No, I mean, every state always wants to be a law-abiding, you know, state, you know, in international, you know, international platforms, and the fact that there was no legal instrument in place to enforce countries like Israel to start to comply. And the fact that now we do have a treaty, you know, the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, and that makes it illegal, you know, to own those weapons. And by default, countries like Israel will have to comply if they want to claim to be a law-abiding state.
Well, as you know, there are some other laws regarding the settlement expansions of Israel that are illegal, mind you, under international law, and they still do it. You know, I was wondering if the same policy can be followed by the Israeli cabinet, you know, as far as this new treaty is concerned.
I think it's these are two different issues. Even if Israel has always behaved the way it has behaved in the past, but when it comes to disarmament issues, it's a different ballgame. And And the fact that I think, for example, U.S. was a signatory to the Arms Trade Treaty, which generally U.S. has always been opposed to, not only the ATT, but all the other disarmament. If you look at all the disarmament issues, you'll see that U.S. has always been reluctant to be party to these international instruments. But with the change of government, I think we are hoping that the new administration will quickly come on board and ratify the Arms Trade Treaty, for example. Mm. And with that, we can then try to persuade the U.S. to consider its position on nuclear weapons. I think we're hoping in 10 years' time, we'll see countries like Britain changing its position and dismantling the weapons. And I think it's possible. Mm. The fact that South Africa was able, you know, when in 1994 was able to stop the program. They used to have nuclear weapons, but they stopped the program and dismantled the nuclear heads. So I think it's possible to get countries like U.S., Britain, and France, as well as Israel, to come on board.
Sir, one final question. I'm sorry to jump in there. One final question. We're just quickly running out of time for this interview, but I'd really like to get your very valuable opinion about this as well. Don't you find it somehow ironic that this is a treaty that is putting a curb on the number of nuclear weapons, and I'm saying weapons, and there are some five countries with the largest stockpiles of them, and they haven't signed it? Don't you find this ironic? Please, under a minute, please.
No, I don't think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there are many countries, you know, in the disarmament who, for example, you know, when we had landmines, you know, people had huge amounts of stockpiles. But where are they today? So I think it's possible. And I'm positive and excited that the nuclear weapons are now illegal. Mm-hmm. And we're going to win this battle. In 5-10 years' time, we'll see a difference when countries start to dismantle their programs. Thank you.
Yeah, your positive view gives a new spirit, sir, I got to say. Thank you very, very much. That's Mr. Joseph Dube. He is an arms control activist and campaigner who joined us with his valuable comments via Skype out of the city of Johannesburg. Sir, I really appreciate your time. Have a good day. Let's move on to another story now. Officials in the Syrian province of Hama say 4 civilians have been killed in the latest Israeli attack on the country. The officials say those killed were from the same family. They say several more people were wounded in the Israeli attack. Israel carried out its strikes early on Friday, firing a barrage of missiles towards Hama province in western Syria. Damascus said it had repelled the attack, downing most of the missiles. Israel frequently launches airstrikes on Syria. Damascus has repeatedly condemned the move as a violation of its sovereignty. It has filed complaints to the United Nations calling for a halt to the Israeli attacks. International lawyer Mr. Barry Grossman believes the United Nations is unwilling to stop Israel's aggression against the regional countries, including Syria.
As for the United Nations, I wouldn't hold my breath expecting any action from the United Nations. Of course, it's quite clear that these ongoing attacks by Israel are a violation not only of Syrian sovereignty, but of international law and the law of armed conflict. But the sad reality is that not only is Israel not in any way amenable to diplomatic pressure, but there really is no judicial mechanism that can be invoked through the UN or in any other way to hold Israel accountable and compel it to stop these violations.
Iraqi people have held a funeral for the victims of a twin bomb attack in the capital, Baghdad. Mourners participated in the funeral procession while shouting religious chants. They carried the coffins of the victims toward a cemetery for burial. Two male bombers blew themselves up in a crowded market in Baghdad. The explosions killed at least 32 people and wounded another 110. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Political commentator Ali Annashmi says the Daesh terrorist group is making a resurgence in Iraq thanks to U.S.-Israeli efforts to weaken the country's popular mobilization units.
There is many injured, more than 100, and the martyrs is more than 30. And no one declared till now about who's behind it. But I think there is many wings or many directions behind that, and especially now the ISILs increasing their action in the Iraq, especially in this period when the government and the Western and American and Israel, they targeted the popular mobilization and the people now shouting against them, and they listen for this media against the popular mobilization, and there is a policy now from 6 months to reducing or to weakening popular mobilization. Then they used that kind of weakening and they escaped and come in the central of Baghdad and using the explosive belt.
A London-based rights group has urged Nigeria to release top Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife from prison over their deteriorating health condition. The Islamic Human Rights Commission made the call in a letter to Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari. He did so after Zakzaki's wife Zinat tested positive for COVID-19. The rights group called on the UN to help immediately release him. The couple's lawyer says Zinat is yet to be transferred to hospital 6 days after she was diagnosed with the coronavirus. Zakzaki and his wife have remained in jail as part of a crackdown ongoing since December 2015. That is when the Nigerian army attacked the cleric supporters in the northern city of Zaria, killing hundreds of them. Let's get the latest word on the situation within Nigeria from our man, Danjuma Abdullahi, who comes to you via Skype out of the city of Abuja. Danjuma, if you hear me, please fill us in regarding the latest information that is coming out of the Sheikh's case.
Yes, the statement we are getting is we had really three statements. One from Zakzaki's only surviving son, Muhammad, who has stated that his mother has tested positive to COVID-19. Also, we have a statement from the Islamic Movement in Nigeria confirming Zakzaki's wife, Zinat, Ibrahim Zakzaki, has tested positive to the COVID-19. And also, the latest statement is from the Zakzaki's lawyer, Haruna Magashi, who said that, who expressed bewilderment, really, that the Kaduna State government is very serious about COVID-19. It has taken very strict measures to ensure that it observes the protocol of the COVID-19. So it is bewildered. He said he is bewildered that 6 days after Malama Zinat Zakzaki has tested positive, there is no effort to take her to a medical facility. There is no effort to isolate her or to find out who has visited her and who has not. So it is really bewildered. It says that it is suspecting foul play about the case. Now, what the statements we are getting right now is one-sided, is from the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, is from Zakzaki's lawyer. The government, as usual, the Kaduna State government, has not issued any statement regarding the COVID-19 status of Zakzaki's wife. Federal government has not issued any statement. So the information we are getting is really from one side of the issue. I have made an attempt to call an official of the Kaduna State government. He has not replied me before going on air. I wanted, in the interest of fairness, to call and find out if there is a statement regarding the medical condition of Zazaki's wife, but mm-hmm. I have not received a reply mm-hmm. as of when I am going on air for this Skype interview.
That's Danjuma Abdullahi. Danjuma, I'm going to have to let you go because we're just running late for our other news items. So thank you very much for that update. Hopefully I will talk to you when you have more information on the health of both the Sheikh and his wife. That's our man in Abuja. Let's move on to another story now. Japan says it'll hold the Tokyo Olympics this year, denying reports of the cancellation of the Games.
We will press ahead with preparations for the Tokyo Games with the determination of building tight anti-infection measures and holding an event that can bring hope and courage to the world.
Tokyo organizers have time and again pledged to hold the Games scheduled to open on July the 23rd. Currently, much of Japan is under a state of emergency due to a third wave of COVID infections. The public remains deeply concerned about hosting thousands of international athletes during the pandemic. Organizers say they are working with the government to implement necessary precautions and measures. The Japanese government and International Olympic Committee postponed the Tokyo Games in March of last year because of the pandemic. Now, a group of U.S. Republicans has asked President Joe Biden for a tougher response to China's sanctions on over two dozen former administration officials. House Republican Michael McCaul said the sanctions were a brazen attempt to silence officials who had exposed abuses. He said President Biden must respond immediately and forcefully. Senate Republican Jim Rich said American lawmakers must show China that the U.S. is determined to defend its interests. On Wednesday, China sanctioned 28 officials of Donald Trump's administration, including his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The Biden administration called the move unproductive and cynical. It said China, by making the announcement on Inauguration Day, appeared to be attempting to play into U.S. divisions. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is reviewing a request from Republicans to put off the start of former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial until mid-February. A spokesman for Schumer said he had received a proposal from Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell for the trial delay. McConnell has said that he wants Democrats to hold off on sending the impeachment charge to the Senate until January the 28th. He's also asked them to give Trump 2 weeks from that day to prepare a defense. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Trump's impeachment trial will be soon, but she has not said when the article of impeachment will be sent to the Senate. Pelosi said she will consult with fellow Democrats about the issue. And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. A majority of American voters surveyed in the wake of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol believe that twice impeached Donald Trump should be barred from ever running for office again, according to polling results reported exclusively by The Hill on Tuesday, January 19th. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading 57% of U.S. voters want Trump barred from seeking office ever again. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A majority of American voters surveyed in the wake of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol believe that twice impeached Donald Trump should be barred from ever running for office again, according to polling results reported exclusively by The Hill on Tuesday, January 19th, his last full day in office. The survey was conducted by the Center for American Political Studies at Harvard University and the Harris poll from January 12th to 14th. It found that 57% of U.S. voters think Trump, who entered politics in 2015 to run for president, shouldn't be allowed to seek office in the future, compared with 43% who don't support such a ban. Trump still faces a trial in the U.S. Senate after House Democrats, joined by just 10 Republicans, voted last week to impeach him for inciting the violent siege of the Capitol on January 6th with his repeated lies about the November election. Although 87% of Democratic voters want Trump barred from running for political office again, 76% of Republicans disagree. The poll also showed that voters are largely split on impeachment, with 51% calling the effort legitimate given that he provoked the Capitol attack, and 49% accusing lawmakers of playing politics. The post-Capitol riot polling on Trump is mixed, as he maintained a fairly high job approval rating in our poll, but 48% said he should be impeached versus censure or doing nothing, and a majority favored a ban on his running in the future. Mark Penn, the director of Harvard CAPS Harris poll, told The Hill. This was seen as an appropriate penalty at this point. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Tuesday, January 19th, made clear that restoring trust in U.S. democracy is a key priority, with Democrats set to take control of the chamber on Wednesday by the slimmest margin possible, with Kamala Harris breaking any tie voters. The Democratic leader said on the Senate floor on Tuesday, January 19th, that Trump is a threat to our constitutional order, and after what he has done, the consequences of which we were all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again. So let me be clear, there will be an impeachment trial in the United States Senate, Schumer said. There will be a vote on convicting the president for high crimes and misdemeanors, and if the president is convicted, there will be a vote on barring him from running again. After a pair of Democrats who won runoff races in Georgia and Harris' replacement are sworn in, there will be a 50-50 split in the Senate. Two-thirds of senators would have to vote to convict Trump. Schumer is reportedly working out a power-sharing agreement with outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has come under fire in recent days for not immediately reconvening after the House impeachment vote. Neither Schumer nor McConnell nor House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said when the trial will begin, but according to The Hill, the earliest one could start. If the House submits the article of impeachment afternoon, shortly after Biden is sworn in, or Thursday afternoon. Toronto on Tuesday, January 19th, publicly accused Trump of inciting the Capitol attack for the first time, saying on the Senate floor, "The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people, and they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like," unquote. Some progressives responded by calling out the GOP leader for delaying a trial until after Biden's inauguration, especially given that lawmakers and Trump's cabinet faced demands to remove him from office via the impeachment process or the 25th Amendment immediately after the right-wing mob stormed the Capitol. As Representative Rashida Tlaib put it, "Speeches aren't enough. Do your job and start impeachment trial," said Representative Ilhan Omar in response to McConnell's remarks. "It's time to act beyond statements." The new survey results and continued pressure on Senate leaders come after a Washington Post-ABC News poll released recently showed that 54% of Americans, including one in eight Republicans, feel that Trump should be charged with the crime of inciting a riot for his speech that preceded the storming of the Capitol.
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Massive military drills of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps have come to an end. This after the IRGC has put on quite a show from central Iran to the Indian Ocean. Mock enemy vessels were targeted with long-range ballistic missiles with precision accuracy, hitting targets up to 1,800 kilometers away. Tehran says the maneuvers sent a message to adversaries to avoid attacking Iran, and military officers reiterate that Iran's might is for defensive means only. Stay with us as we take a look at these maneuvers on this debate.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day massive military exercise in central Iran. During the drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, IRGC destroyed mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. The operations were launched in the presence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said Iranian armed forces will respond with might and promptly in case of any hostile move against the Islamic Republic. The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The maneuvers are aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The military drills come amid America's stepped-up military threats against Iran in the final days of U.S. President Donald Trump in office. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and imposed heavy sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Trump cited Iran's ballistic missile program, among other issues, as the reason. Tehran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. Like any other country, the Islamic Republic is entitled to boost its defense capabilities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Helsinki, and author and journalist Eric Wahlberg out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Brett. Tell us the significance of these latest drills and the timing of them in your perspective.
Well, I think the timing, of course, is of supreme importance here. We're talking about a very dangerous, very volatile time, being the last week now even, of the Donald Trump presidency. We know that Donald Trump is not exactly the most, let's say, a held back person, not necessarily the most rational person as well when it comes to international policy in particular. We have seen what he is capable of. We have seen both domestically and in foreign affairs what he can do when he sets his mind to something, and it's not pretty. You know, it's nothing to be proud of. So, of course, for the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, this is a very dangerous and threatening time. So I think that this is the perfect timing, indeed, to show such an impressive military advancement. We're talking about, according to sources within the Iranian military, that these long-distance ballistic missiles, these missiles that were fired at naval targets, this is a reach that has now been expanded from 300 kilometers in the past to 1,800 kilometers now, which means the Islamic Republic of Iran could fend off a naval aggression over 1,800 kilometers away before they would ever come anywhere near actually reaching the Iranian coast. So this is a very important symbol and a very important signal to make right now, to show that not just the people of the armed forces of Iran are ready to defend their country, but we're also talking about a very modern, high-tech military that has a drone and missile program at the ready in order to defend itself in case of any aggression.
Well, Eric, with what was displayed during the maneuvers and what you've seen, I want to ask you your perspective about the message that it could send and also about the preparedness of Iranian forces.
Well, I agree with Brett. This is a very important step that Iran takes at a very serious, crucial moment when Trump is still threatening and when Biden is coming to power with promises to de-escalate the tensions with Iran and to return to the JCOA peace, so the nuclear agreement. So I think that it's not an aggressive move. It's quite clearly it's a defensive move, and it's important for this point to be made before Biden is pushed by his Zionist backers to try and tell Iran to stop supporting Syria, to stop supporting the Houthis, to stop to stop the Israeli-U.S. aggression in the Middle East. That Iran's military might is dedicated to self-defense and to defending its allies in the region, and there's nothing subversive about this. It's all above board. It's all according to international law. And so I'm very comfortable to see these demonstrations, and it is encouraging to know that whereas Israel and U.S. are at the forefront of military production of offensive weapons, that Iran is not going to be held hostage to these clear enemies of peace in the Middle East.
Well, actually, Eric, I want to pick up on what you just said. You said you're very comfortable seeing this. Brett, I want to look at that because, of course, we know how Iran is portrayed by many countries, especially Western countries, trying to show that it's basically a very aggressive country. What Eric just said, that he was comfortable because of showing it's the domestic and also defensive capability as opposed to offensive. I want to look at that aspect of it. Why is it that though Iran has not engaged in an offensive war in 200 years in modern history, it is continually labeled and condemned for being an aggressive nation?
Well, this is all, of course, part of the propaganda mill. Indeed, as Eric pointed out, the Zionist backers behind much of the Western governments, of the so-called leaders of the Western world, the Zionists and the imperialist war hawks in general, they have an extensive influence in trying to basically beef up these war drums and beef up this war propaganda. And one of their most commonly used phrases, of course, is projection, is basically one of the most common tactics of projection, that with which I mean everything that the West does wrong is being projected on another country as if it comes from them. The Western powers will say that these other nations are the ones that are potentially imperialist, expansionist, aggressive, colonialist, or neocolonialist, and are a threat to the nations surrounding them. We have seen similar, very clear examples of this in 2018, when Donald Trump made his demands to Iran. These demands include that Iran has to pull, quote-unquote, pull back from Iraq, even though they are there with the permission of the Iraqi government. They have to, quote-unquote, withdraw from Yemen, even though Iran is not involved in Yemen at all. They have to, you know, disengage from Syria, even though the Syrian Arab Republic has specifically asked, of course, for Iranian support in their defense against these terrorist movements that are, incidentally, backed by the West. So they project these sins and these crimes of the West and try to portray it as if it's Iran that does it, as if it's, for example, also the same thing happens with China, the same thing happens with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. All every time when a nation that is not marching to the beat of the Zionists, to the beat of the imperialists in the West, they are portrayed as these madmen that are running around trying to destroy the world. And indeed, when you look at the situation on the ground, you see that Iran is surrounded on all sides by, you know, American bases, American forces, American soldiers, vessels, ships, planes, and the entire, you know, cabal of the military-industrial complex of the United States, and in many ways also the United Kingdom, France, and much of the European Union, and of course the regional allies and puppet states such as Saudi Arabia. And so these, in order to masquerade what is going on here, the democratic West, as they call themselves, are trying to portray this orientalist image of the basically a return to the old, you know, medieval and later Nazi propaganda of the hordes from the East, let's say, that are threatening the democratic West, the civilized West, so to say. This is a tale that has been going on for centuries, and in a modern capacity we have seen this return time and again. We have seen this happen during the Korean War, we have seen this happen during the Vietnam War, we have seen this during the war against Iraq, the war against Syria, the war against Libya, and this is something that returns over and over again. So this is a psychological warfare, and unfortunately it has been very, very successful up until recently. Now, fortunately, nowadays we have, of course, the internet and in alternative independent media to combat this monopolization of press and monopolization of the written word that has been dominating the West for so long, but it still remains very, very difficult. And this is, of course, why the Iranian authorities call this the soft war. This is a war of its own, the war of words, the war of truth versus lies, that in many ways is equally important to the actual war of bombs and guns. And this is what is going on here right now, and the war that is being fought in the minds of people every single day.
Okay. Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at... Breck just talked about the war of words. I want to go back to the actual physical war. 40 years ago, of course, when Iran was basically attacked by Saddam Hussein's led Iraq. And of course, Iran tried to get equipment and weapons from everywhere, but basically to no avail, with the help of the U.S. and its allies. We fast forward now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and we see the type of technology being used, and a lot of this missile technology, homegrown. I want to look at that aspect and the significance of Iran being able to do this under such severe sanctions.
It's, to me, it's a miracle. I every day I think, wow, Iran is fighting the monster, and it's got enough intellectual capability to do that. And that it really is very impressive. I think that if we can get that message out to people will, it's not to make people afraid of Iran, it's to make people respect Iran and its attempt to forge an independent and socially just orientation in the international sphere. And I wanted to commend Brett on his psychoanalysis of the situation, that you looked at someone like Trump. He is really psychologically, he's a very seriously tormented individual, and this projection that you see this every day, that people, they're full of hate and they project that hate onto someone else and say you are the problem. So I think this is on the world scale, we're having a lesson in the human tragedy and the human comedy.
Well, Eric, let me just jump in here, because you talked about as far as Trump and projection. But is this a Trump problem? I mean, if we look at the history of the Islamic Republic of Iran, almost 42 years old now since the revolution, we've seen from the beginning this type of animosity that Washington has had against Tehran. And whether we're talking about a Democrat like Carter or a Republican with Reagan, or we fast forward all the way to Trump, it really hasn't seemed to have changed between the Democrats and Republicans as far as that animosity towards Iran and actually basically changing the narrative, as Brett has said, what they have done and their aggression, actually trying to show that it has been Iran. Let me throw this to Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, this is definitely a key point to make in terms of, you know, American politics. Yes, Donald Trump might be the mad dog of U.S. imperialism in a way, although I highly doubt that Donald Trump is the person who actually came up with things like, you know, assassinating Shahid Qasem Soleimani or the nuclear scientists in Iran who were murdered under his rule. He is more of a person who is... He is the dog let loose, let's say, of U.S. imperialism, whereas a person like Obama was a person who could show more restraint and could pretend to be more diplomatic. But in the end, their goals are the same. You know, we should not kid ourselves and believe that the United States under Obama was using the JCPOA for a lasting peace. No, for them, they were hoping that through the JCPOA, they could somehow tame Iran into having, you know, like a velvet counter-revolution, you know, like one of those color revolutions that they have been doing in Eastern Europe ever since the late 1980s. You know, they were probably hoping for something like that. Whereas the war hawks of people like, you know, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and what have you, they are more of the, you know, the blood and fire kind of types who want to destroy the nation completely, everyone who is standing in their way, and basically see the destruction all over the place until the United States reigns supreme. But in the end, of course, their goals are similar. Indeed, we have seen aggressive behavior from Democrats like Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, just as we have seen it from Reagan, Bush, and Trump. This is a cabal, again, to say that word, of a two-headed snake, let's say. These are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Both Democrats and Republicans eventually serve the same interests and have been serving the same interests ever since the country of the United States was founded. This is an issue that has been going on for decades and even centuries. So when you see, you know, Joe Biden take the lead and say, I want to return back to the JCPOA, I want to return back to the negotiation table, we have to be very, very suspicious of their intention, because Joe Biden has said, and that's very important, I believe, He said, we want to negotiate back with Iran, but only, and there it comes, of course, if Iran, quote-unquote, keeps strictly to the rules and regulations and the stipulations of the JCPOA. And the problem is that the Americans have shown time and again that their interpretation of what is written in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not necessarily what a normal person, you know, a neutral observer, mm-hmm. would believe that it says. They might use this document in order to pressure and push Iran even further.
And what we've seen, Brad, you were talking about using the JCPOA, and we've seen actually Trump talk about this, and others have hinted at it. Again, looking now at the missile technology. And, Eric, I want to talk about that, because in these maneuvers that we just saw, one of it was actually Iran flexing its muscles with that missile technology. And there are those who say that even under a Biden administration, that perhaps they're going to try to go after that. Overall, I just want to look at this situation, and where do you think this is all going at this point in time between the United States and Iran?
Well, I don't really agree exactly with Brett, or perhaps with you, on the fact that There is a cabal, and they're all the same in Washington. I think that that was a brave move that Obama made. I don't know why he made it. I think he was trying to get to put Israel in its place, because the Stutz worm that was destroying the Iranian nuclear facilities for a while, that was a U.S.-sponsored secret program that was supposed to be under U.S. control, and Israel took it and ran and did what it wanted. So I think that there is a difference, and I think that Biden is a continuation of Obama. He must be aware of all of that background. He's no fool. And I think that I look at this, it's the same way as when there was detente with the Soviet Union in the 70s, when the U.S. was weak and it made an agreement with the Soviet Union, and it was very positive. It was very positive for the world. It relaxed the tensions. And I really hope, and perhaps I'm being too optimistic, but I hope that Biden will fulfill his pledge to return to the program, allow Iran to get its economy back in shape, and to live peacefully in the region with the other people. Iran is not an enemy of Israel. If Israel would just stop being such aggressive and horrible nation, everyone could make peace with it. So I think that Iran plays a vital role here to stand up to the power and speak the truth. And I really hope that that will happen. I'm trying to be optimistic. We've got a few days before Biden comes to power. Let's hope that he does what he should.
Well, Brett, your take. Eric said basically, obviously you heard him, that he's very optimistic. But what it seems, that if we look again at the more than four decades of the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is that Washington has a problem with Iran being independent and even morally supporting other independent movements. Your take on the future between these two countries now?
Of course, it's very hard to predict, let's say, or to think about what will happen. But I always try, of course, to be, you know, somewhat optimistic myself in regards of what the future might bring. You don't want to look at it too negatively, of course. But I believe that there is a chance that the United States will eventually learn to, you know, leave Iran alone and let Iran, you know, develop its country the way they want to, and develop ties with whatever country they want to, and within the axis of resistance, for example, and beyond, and that America will eventually learn how to cope with it, to deal with it. But I believe the only way in which this is possible is by Iran basically building up its capacities for self-defense and its say, its weight in world politics to such an extent that the United States will be forced to recognize the situation as it is. I believe one of the examples I could use for a nation that has in the past faced incredible hostility from the United States and is now considered by the United States as a normal, respectable partner in everyday politics is Vietnam. Of course, I sincerely hope that Iran does not have to go through the terrible tragedy that Iran had to go through for decades in order to get to that position. But it is a fact that the United States was eventually forced, starting in the, you know, mid and late 1970s, to declare that they were basically, that they had been defeated, that their goals, their plans had been foiled, had failed completely due to the resistance and resilience of the Vietnamese. And ever since then, give or take certain disagreements, the United States and Iran and Vietnam are treating each other more or less as equal partners, as just normal nations that conduct diplomacy and trade with one another. Okay. So eventually, if Iran really shows itself to be the strong regional power that they are and that they have every right to be, I believe only that will eventually force the United States to come to the conclusion that they cannot win this policy of maximum pressure anymore.
So resistance and strength is what you said. Thanks so much for being with us. Brett Yonkers, journalist and historian out of Helsinki, and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist out of Toronto. And thank you for being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Glad to have you with us. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in gharn mojza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojza asay farnas.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and of course, shaped all our tomorrows. I'm your expert host, Ijaz Husseini, on this program, and we left off in our last program at the point where we were discussing about leadership and the importance of the uniqueness of the Shia leadership, particularly in the school of Ahlul Bayt, and that at various times through the life and times of Imam Khomeini, of course, which is what this program is devoted to, is showing that in his early life, how Imam Khomeini supported the religious authorities of the time, especially in the holy city of Qom, where the Hawza system was established in the early 20th century. And we are looking at various aspects of what that unique leadership, especially the Shia leadership, what it actually means, what it does in terms of sometimes being passive, sometimes being active, depending on the circumstances in which that leadership found itself to be, according to the political oppression, if you like, at the time, that was occurring during the constitutional movement in Iran, which was really hijacked by the British machinations of the time. And we are looking at aspects of this throughout this program. And hopefully, we'll also touch upon Imam Khomeini, may God's blessings be upon him, his earlier scholarship as well, and how quickly he became a mujtahid of the time. So we'll look into those aspects as well. And I have the honor of having Sayyid Taqi Razvi from the Holy Seminaries in Qom to discuss all these various aspects and dimensions of the Holy Imam's life. Salam and hello and welcome to you, sir, once again on the program.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us and giving us your valuable time. Now, sir, we were at the point, you know, as you mentioned, and very interestingly enough, that you took us to India in Lucknow, and you pointed out the fact that, you know, of course, when the British were, you know, expanding their empire in India and overthrowing the Mughal Empire at the time, how that was affecting Imam Khomeini's grandfather, who, you know, was a very active participant in the Hawzas of Lucknow, as you mentioned. And then you went on to the fact that how his grandfather left because of the difficult circumstances that, you know, the British were posing, you know, for the ulama, especially the Shia ulama in Lucknow. So if you'd like us to take us into that aspect, and then hopefully we'll go on to the, you know, the role of the various Shia leadership as we were discussing from Qom as well as in Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think briefly we touched on it, and whilst we're discussing the lineage of Imam Khomeini,
that's
we talked
right,
about
yes.
his lineage of his great-great-grandfather, who was known as Al-Hindi.
Al-Hindi, yes,
and,
yes, that's
originally,
right.
I mean, he said Ahmad Musavi Al-Hindi, he was known as. And he resided in Lucknow, and it was quite interesting that the reason for his migration for Lucknow is recorded by Imam Khomeini's brother, Ayatollah Pasandideh.
Yes,
that
yes.
it was not because he just wanted to up and go. Or
he
moved on to Kashmir. He in fact decided to move because of the expansions of the East Indian Company.
That's
and
right.
the British expansion in particularly this area of India, which was a dominant leadership there, was the Shia dynasty there,
right.
the Uday dynasty.
Right, the Uday dynasty.
And
right.
they were, slowly, they had become subservient to the East Indian Company. To this British East Indian Company,
right.
Because slowly the East Indian Company was buying commissions into this this dynasty,
right.
of the O'Day family,
right.
And eventually the history of this family is that they took up the whole of Lucknow and then exiled this the king of or the Sultan of O'Day to Calcutta.
Right.
Where he just finally resided there and did his last years of his life with his numerous wives and children and so on,
right.
Left him in that kind of area of
right.
self-enjoyment,
right.
rather than running and being
sure.
an authority.
And this is where your point is very, very important, that, you know, as Ayatollah al-Hindi is going there for the simple purpose of the guidance of the Muslims on the time to make them understand what is going on and, you know, how this is going to affect them in the long run.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the British, of course, you know, with their designs for India is to, you know, completely eradicate Muslim rule in India that had been established itself for 8 centuries.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want to bit by bit, you know, take it apart, and they're going to start by, of course, attacking the clergy. You know, they're going to attack the very people who were the glue to keeping this together. So, you know, yeah.
So he decides that this British intrusion in Lucknow and the Muslim community
right.
was going to be detrimental, and he would not be able to have any type of impact within that kind of changing environment of
right.
the Nawabs and the Rajas all becoming subservient and slaves to the governor of Her Majesty the Queen Victoria type of
course.
Thing.
Of
so,
course.
You know, he could not take that as being subserviency and subduing
right.
one's position.
Right.
So he up and left, and our history opens up to such a level that then we went down the track of introducing how he landed up in Khomeini. But
yes.
what is interesting is this standing against the oppression, this innate bloodline
yes,
of,
yes.
of the family.
Mm.
You know, we see Imam Khomeini's father himself becoming martyred by the gangster of the time in Iran, Khomeini.
Yes.
And then you see Imam Khomeini himself, an unhesitant confrontation with the evil.
That's right.
Being in his bloodstream,
at
the very basic age of 15, 16, he's identifying the enemy.
I mean, this is a quote that we get from Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, where he says that I am not going to allow myself or my adherents to become bullied by any other human being. You know, I mean, he makes it known right from the start that he's not going to be allowed to be bullied and is not going to allow himself to be oppressed by somebody else's wishes or desires, which, of course, you know, are run against Sharia and run against Islam.
And you see, we see this as Imam Khomeini develops, that he is continuously eyeing the changes around him.
Yeah.
But as we said, he never confronted the leadership which is representing the Shia opinion at that time.
Of course.
There's a lovely ayat in the Quran, which is Surah Bani Israel,
right.
17th Surah, ayat number 71, which is very easy to remember, 1771, being the mirror of each other.
Right.
And the ayat says, the day we shall summon every group of people with the Imam.
Imam.
So Imam Khomeini, from this ayat we can see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has guaranteed this, that whatever opinion you have, that individual, if he's leading a people, he will be summoned on the Day of Judgment as the Imam of those people.
Sure.
And consequently, for example, Karl Marx will be summoned as the Imam of the communists.
Yes, absolutely.
And given the right beating for being so, you know, on the
right,
Day of Judgment.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, each individual... So, yeah. There's a double barrel responsibility.
That's
here.
Right, because that particular verse in the Quran refers to imams being either good or bad.
It
you know?
Will. That's
yeah.
the whole purpose.
Yeah, that's
that
the whole
people
purpose.
Would be called with their imams.
Mm.
So if you've taken on a bad imam, then the question arises: can you defend yourself in that situation?
Exactly.
On the Day of Judgment, you will be called with your imam.
Yeah.
You can't say at the doors, "Excuse me, but I was misled." You had the
it's
responsibility.
A bit late for that,
too late for that, but
yeah.
what also the fact that you had a defined responsibility to find he who is the right person.
Sure.
Imam Khomeini characterized this ayat's impression that he would take on the he would go for the right identities, but when the imam is identified in front of him, he will toe the line.